Taxes, you can't live with them, you can't run a government without them. What the Congress and the White House have in mind for us from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, the 24th of April. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. You know how sometimes on a Friday I say, man, that was quite the economic week, huh? Well, here you go. Friday's news on a Monday. This is going to be quite an economic week. Forget that much rumored but highly unlikely vote on the GOP healthcare plan for a minute. And let's talk about things that are at least somewhat in the realm of things the White House can control. Specifically, whether or not the government's going to shut down come Friday night. But also, and really of far greater significance, the president's promise to roll out his tax reform plan on Wednesday. Republican Kevin Brady of Texas is the chairman of the all-important House Ways and Means Committee, often called the Tax Writing Ways and Means Committee. Sir, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you, Kai.
So the Wall Street Journal reports today that you and the rest of the tax leadership and the Congress are going to the White House to meet with Secretary Mnuchin and the head of the National Economic Council, Gary Cohn, tomorrow. Is that happening?
Yeah, it is. I think it's pretty important. I think one of the key elements for tax reform this year, which is really the first time in 30 years we've had this opportunity, is for the White House, the House, and the Senate to get on the same page, especially on the big issues, the big principles that go with tax reform.
What's on the table then?
Well, so look, we're in the House, in my discussions with President Trump, is that, look, we recognize this happens once in a generation, and the code we got today is so costly and complex, and it's just broken. And so we're trying to design a tax code built for growth that leapfrogs America into the top three best places on the planet for that next new job or plant. So we're proposing, and I think the president will as well, the lowest tax rates on our job creators, whether they're local business, small businesses, or major ones, in history. Tax code so fair and simple, most Americans will be able to file using a postcard system. And then I'm hopeful the president joins with us in busting up the IRS. We think we need a new agency for the 21st century.
Come on, a postcard? Seriously?
Yeah, for about 9 out of 10 Americans, we've designed a system that is that fair and that simple. It flattens the brackets out to just three. About 95% of Americans will be able to file using that simple an approach.
President Trump has talked about getting the corporate tax rate down to 15%, sir. How are you going to do that, and how are you going to flatten out the individual tax rates and keep all those deductions without blowing a hole in the deficit?
Yeah, I think for us to make sure this is revenue neutral, counting on economic growth, by the way, which lets us go much bolder in tax reform. So on the business side, you know, I think we can get close to 15 or certainly at 20, and which puts us makes us very, very competitive worldwide. And we can also stop taxing our American businesses worldwide, and we can make sure that all products are taxed equal in the U.S. You do that, that leapfrogs us to the top three. And again, with the families as well, you can't keep those hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of special provisions for some and lower tax rates for everybody. So you got to be willing to trade off some of those provisions to make sure you're really giving people a lot more, and businesses, a lot more control of what they earn.
Yeah, but let's be clear here on the growth thing, sir, because Secretary Mnuchin said this again today. He said these tax cuts are going to pay for themselves with growth. I think that's what you're saying. But you're betting on the come, right? Because we haven't had the kind of growth y'all are talking about in years.
Well, regrettably, under the past president, you know, we averaged less than 2% growth, which
right.
is half of what we've been doing as a country, and certainly a lot less than we normally do. We bounce back from recessions like no other country does, but not this last time. So we're counting not on our own projections, but on an independent source, the Joint Committee on Taxation, to really lay out what kind of growth we'll see. Tax Foundation, independent group, estimates under the House tax reform plan, our economy will grow by over 9%, and more importantly, our wages by nearly 8%. So that's those are good, strong, achievable numbers.
Those are extraordinary numbers. Let me ask you, sir, about timing. You have said, and you just said it a minute or two ago, it's a generational thing to do tax reform the way you are talking about doing it. Why are you squeezing it in then, according to the White House's timetable?
Well, I think it's important to get it done this year. Our economy really continues to struggle. I know the unemployment rate is down, but boy, we've left millions of people out of jobs. Young people just leaving school can't find jobs. A lot of people just giving up.
Let me make sure I heard you. We're going to get this done this year. That's what you're saying.
Yes, sir. 2017 is our goal to get this done.
All right. Is it going to be a bipartisan plan? We had Jason Furman, who, as you know, is President Obama's economic advisor. He was on the program a couple of weeks ago saying, listen, this has to be bipartisan to get it to stick. Do you buy that?
Well, I would like to see it bipartisan. I mean, that's the best way to do tax reform. But I don't know. We've engaged Democrats, invited them to bring us their tax reform ideas. I think they've got some good ones. But they're in a pretty tough place right now. They're really pretty obsessed against President Trump. So I'd love to see him come to the table. That's the best way to do things. But if they decide to obstruct, I think using that budget process that allows a simple majority in the Senate may be the way it has to be done.
Let me ask you one more thing, sir, and then I'll let you go. Is the government still going to be in business Saturday morning, or y'all going to shut it down?
Yeah, I think it will be. Look, I don't think there's any issues that can't be resolved. Unless Democrats are really ready to shut this government down, I don't believe Republicans are.
Well, you say the Democrats being ready to shut it down, but last time I checked, Republicans control the Congress and the White House, sir.
Well, Kai, as you know, the Senate takes 60 votes to pass these budget agreements. That means 8 Democrats at least have to support it. And so in the Senate, there has to be a bipartisan deal. And so the question will really be, what will Democrats insist upon in order to vote yes to keep the government open? And I don't know yet. I think they're all over the road.
Kevin Brady, he's the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. Sir, thanks very much for your time. I do appreciate it.
Take care.
One other Washington policy thing before we go on. Also on Wednesday, as it happens, the new chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Ajit Pai, is scheduled to roll out his new plan for net neutrality, basically whether internet providers are treated like utilities, which is where things were left at the end of the Obama FCC, or whether companies like AT&T and Charter, just for instance, will simply agree not to slow down some kinds of internet traffic. On Wall Street today, ooh la la. Come on, think about it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross met with the European Union's trade negotiator in Washington today. Though it's been buried by immigration and foreign policy the first 3 or so months of the Trump administration, fixing trade was, in his words, after immigration, a key promise that candidate Trump made on the campaign trail, which is why Secretary Ross is out there looking for a win. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
Wilbur Ross, in an interview published in the Financial Times today, said the EU will be in competition with China and Japan for the first trade deal with the Trump administration. Julius Sen is an international trade expert at the London School of Economics.
An agreement with the EU is better and bigger than any potential agreement with any other entity in the world.
The U.S. has a $146 billion trade deficit with Europe, second only to its $347 billion shortfall with China. The U.S. and EU have been in talks since 2013 on a deal called the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP. It'll be up to Trump's team to breathe life back into the deal. University of Michigan professor Linda Lim says that will be harder because the U.K. is leaving the EU.
The UK was always pressing for less regulation, less stringent standards than the continental EU countries.
Lim says a deal with Japan might be easier. It's already made clear what it wants during 7 years of negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a regional trade deal which the U.S. has now pulled out of. Dennis Novi teaches economics at the University of Warwick in the UK.
So it seems that the White House is still making up its mind as to how it ultimately wants to go ahead with trade negotiations.
He says even if Trump makes up his mind and things move quickly, don't hold your breath. Trade deals often require long and difficult negotiations. Novi says he'd be surprised if anything were finalized before the next presidential election. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
We've said, I don't know how many times on this program, that headline numbers aside, the economy is only as good as it feels to the people living in it. We've done a whole bunch of stories the past couple of years looking at exactly that. We've been quantifying it as well with our partners at Edison Research in our Marketplace Edison Research National Economic Poll, the latest version of which, and the first, by the way, since Election Day, has some pretty interesting tidbits in it. It is out today, including an update to our Economic Anxiety Index. Larry Rosen is the president of Edison Research. Larry, it's good to talk to you again.
Hey, Kai.
Give me that headline number, would you, the Economic Anxiety Index out of this thing? Because there have been some changes since last we spoke.
We have been doing this series going back to a year before the election, back to the fall of 2015. And as we've been doing this series, we've watched the level of anxiety that people have about the economy go up and up and up. And this is our first one since the election, and the numbers have actually dropped pretty dramatically, down basically to the level they were in the fall of 2015 when we started this process.
Except it has to be noted for 18 to 24-year-olds who are now more anxious than they've ever been. What gives with that?
The best indication we can see from the study is they are also by far the least in approval for President Trump's management of the economy. Hmm. And of course, they did not vote for Trump in huge numbers. So the best guess is probably that that group is so unhappy with the current political situation, perhaps, that it has increased their anxiety. But what is interesting is that with the exception of that 18 to 24 group, pretty much everybody else reduced on their anxiety level. Mm-hmm. And that's both Republicans and Democrats and independents.
Yeah, you break it down, though, by issue area, and our numbers now show that healthcare as a national economic issue is the biggest thing that people are worrying about.
It sure seems to be. We fielded this study right after the attempt to repeal and replace Obamacare with a new act and then the withdrawal of that, and maybe that heightened the concerns a little bit more. I just think it's an endless cause of stress for so many people, feeling that they're sort of on the razor's edge when it comes to making sure they have coverage and making sure that coverage gets them the health care that they need and that it'll be there going forward.
Which gets us to the next thing that I wanted to point out. 74% of Americans in our poll say they believe the government in Washington has forgotten about them, and that goes across party and identification.
Our study shows that people remain very unhappy and distressed with what Washington is doing for them or to them. And there's no sign yet that a new administration, one that sort of ran against Washington, has been able to reverse that perception at all. So people yet remain very unhappy with Washington and its attempts to help them.
Last thing, Larry, that I want to ask you about is people's perceptions of the economy and specifically economic statistics. The numbers in our last survey show that Republicans generally didn't trust economic statistics from the government. Democrats generally did. And now we find that that has changed, actually.
Yeah, this is so much of the fun of being a survey researcher is watching things like this. So in the lead up to the election, candidate Trump was making a huge issue of the idea that the data you get from the government was untrue. And people seem to follow his lead. Republicans overwhelmingly agreed, and Democrats tended not to agree with that. Right. We asked now that there's a new government, a new administration, and while Republicans are still more likely to think that the data from the government is untrue, their numbers have come way down. Democrats' numbers have come up a little bit, but not as much. So in general, people's distrust of the government is down as compared to when we asked before the election. So it really shows that who's in charge, who's leading the discussion really does have an impact on what people think.
Larry Rosen is the president of Edison Research. They are partners in our national economic surveys that we're doing, the results of which are out today, and we're going to roll out stories all through this week. Marketplace.org is where you can find all the data and all the information from that survey. Larry, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up.
I mean, life is about chapters. It's about choices. It's about rewiring, not retiring.
Sherry Lansing in her second act. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 216 points today, about 1%, 20,763. The NASDAQ gained 73 points, about 1.25%, 5983. The S&P 500 up 25 points, about 1%, 23.74. With the results from the first round of voting in the French presidential election and a look at a couple of French companies, how about the French food company Danone up 2.4%, automaker Peugeot climbed 6.4%, French cosmetics company L'Oreal put on about 2.6%. In Europe, markets were buoyed by the French election results and, oh, by, the hope that the European Union will not fall asunder. The FTSE in Britain up about 2.1%. The CAC 40 in France up 4.1%. Back home, bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.27%. And you are listening to Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
On our podcast, Make Me Smart, we ask our guests this.
What is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about?
If you play by the rules, you win.
Hard lessons from Elevest CEO Sally Krawchuk. Stunning realizations, though, from TV legend Norman Lear.
I wouldn't have said that I was capable of murder.
Trust me, you got to hear that story.
Yeah. And of course, a really important lesson about livestock from the CEO of Reddit.
I thought that a pony was a baby horse.
Turns out it's not. It's just a small horse. Come join the conversation at marketplace.org/makemesmart.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I don't know that Elon Musk has ever said this out loud, but it's pretty clear that one of his organizing management principles is go big or go home. Exhibit A being SpaceX and building rockets that he hopes will one day go to Mars. Exhibit B being Tesla and reconfiguring the entire American car industry, or trying to anyway. His latest gamble is fast-tracking the production strategy for the new Tesla Model 3. No prototype assembly lines for Musk. Oh, no. Straight to full-scale manufacturing. Gutsy, but as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, Tesla can't really afford to wait.
Traditionally, when car companies roll out a new model, they run the assembly line through a prototype phase. And then when all the kinks are worked out, they switch over to hardened steel production tools. Skipping that phase is a big risk, says Auto Pacific analyst Ed Kim, because production snags could crop up later.
Due to faulty tooling or faulty fit and finish of certain pieces and things like that. So, yeah, there is definitely a very big risk here.
Tesla has a history of delays with previous models, and Kim says it has a lot more riding on the $35,000 Model 3.
This is a vehicle that they intend to produce in the sort of quantities that are normally reserved for things like Accords and Camrys and Ford F-Series pickups.
With nearly 400,000 deposit-backed reservations in hand, there's little room for error.
Well, there's an awful lot of folks that have left him deposits, and he's got to make good on that. That's really where his risk is.
Mike Tracy is a manufacturing consultant based in Michigan. He says Elon Musk is also rushing to bring the car to market before the government's $7,500 tax credit for electric vehicles runs out.
There's all the substantial financial risks that go with people who've been promised a vehicle, who think they're going to get rebates, and he won't be able to ramp up and deliver all of that in time.
The bet Musk is making also comes with big rewards. If the shortened ramp-up does work, it could do something Tesla's investors have yet to see in its 14-year history, that is, turn the company into a moneymaker. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
I was inside that Tesla factory up in Fremont, California, not too long ago, looked at all those assembly lines and all the robots. Also, some things you don't normally see in car plants. You can hear that interview with Elon Musk at marketplace.org. Negotiations between the Writers Guild of America and television and movie production companies are in recess today as the union counts membership votes on whether to authorize a strike or not. Watching with not quite detached interest is the former CEO of Paramount Pictures, Sherry Lansing. Lansing, who's the subject of a new biography called Leading Lady, came to Los Angeles in the mid-1960s, initially to be an actress, but in those early days, at least more often teaching English and math in East L.A. By and by, though, she found work behind the camera as a producer and a studio executive, and finally, in 1992, running Paramount, which is where we started when we talked a week or so ago.
Well, when I took over, there had been an absence of a lot of films. So for want of a better word, the cupboard was kind of bare. And the most important thing was to find movies, because no matter what the responsibilities of the job are, no matter how much you have to worry about the parking lot and the commissary and all the bureaucracies of running a studio, your success is simply determined by whether the movies succeed.
The list of movies that you either greenlighted at Paramount or were involved with as a producer is extraordinary. Forrest Gump, Braveheart, Titanic, Fatal Attraction, Private Ryan. Did you know when you came out of, for instance, the test screenings?
So, first of all, that's very kind of you. And I want to say that I certainly did not do this alone, that there was a team of people I worked with who I'm very grateful to. And I also want to say that the filmmakers deserve all the credit. Did I know? There's not a movie that I greenlit that I didn't think would be a huge hit. So let's start with that. I believed in every movie. And I also want to say I worked just as hard on the movies that failed as I worked on the movies that succeeded.
Does that gut you? That must gut you to see a movie fail.
I tell you, you can't get out of bed in the morning. I always felt that I let the filmmakers down, that it was my fault. And it was my fault because I felt that the studio has a responsibility to open the picture. That opening weekend is our marketing. And there were just times like, I was depressed for days. And then you cannot wallow in this. You have to pick yourself up and you have to try again.
And especially in this industry.
Oh, because my God.
Not, listen to you. It's because it's not your best work, right? It's your last work
That's
that
correct.
Everybody looks at.
And that drives me crazy. Everyone should be judged on their best work. So you ask the question, did I know when the test screenings were great? I had certainly high hopes. But then you have to sell it to the public. So there are pictures that had phenomenal test screenings, and the audience didn't come. The one that comes to my mind is Searching for Bobby Fischer. I love that movie.
Yeah.
I think we released it twice. I mean, in case you didn't see it the first time. And they never came.
Yeah.
There are other pictures where the test scores aren't that good, but you can sell them, and they do a lot of business. So it's not just the movie, unfortunately. And that's how I think the business has changed so much since I first got into it and since I was a kid.
Since you brought us up to now and today, and acknowledging that you've been out of the industry, in air quotes, for 10, 12 years now, what do you make of the changes in, I apologize for this word, content production, right? I mean, television now is the place to be, and movies, there are like three movies every year, and they're all huge tentpoles, and that's about it.
So I think it's a thrilling time to be in the business. And even though I left the movie business literally 11 years ago, I am still a huge fan. And when I say movies, I just mean entertainment. To me, it doesn't make any difference whether it's in the local theater or whether it's on my iPad or whether it's on my television. I'm talking about content. So when I was growing up, if you didn't have a studio give you the money to make your movie, you couldn't do it. I say to young filmmakers today, you have an iPhone. Go make your movie. You don't need a lot of money. Go make your movie. Put it on YouTube. Put it on the web. It'll get found.
There's a question I ask people who have moved on from that thing on which they built their career. I can't ask it of you because there's a line in the book that says, you know, when you left, you were burned out and you were upfront about that and you were done. And you now have clearly found your passion in your foundation in philanthropy.
I always knew that my end goal would be to start a foundation and to give back. And I think for me, after, 30 years in the business, I think I was burnt out. The passion, which is the most important thing I had, was kind of moving to something else. And so for me, it was moving to cancer research because I lost my mother to cancer. It was moving to education because I'm a former math and English teacher. But I did love my time in the movie business. I want to be clear about that. It's about chapters. I mean, life is about chapters. It's about choices. It's about rewiring, not retiring. So I feel very, very grateful and very blessed.
Jerry Lansing, thanks very much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
This final note on the way out today, in which the Trump Organization, not administration, gets a bit of a plug from the Department of State. On its Share America website, public diplomacy might be a way to characterize what that site does. There is a page devoted to Mar-a-Lago, the president's Florida resort. The Winter White House is what the State Department calls it. A for-profit, privately owned enterprise would be an apt description as well. All right, we got to go. The stock market word of the day today is merci. The Dow up 216 points, about 1%. NASDAQ up 73 points, nearly 1.25%. The S&P 500 up 25 points, about 1% there as well. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.